Lying under the makuzi tree, idly swatting at the buffalo flies, picking at the grass under his shirt, and harbouring his disappointment, Zugo watched the Hottentot work. Yanshurut reached the hive and blew another stream of smoke over the hole in the cliff, stupefying the bees, which had now formed a swirling defence of cloud about him. One of them darted in, despite the smoke, and stung him in the soft of the neck. Yanshurut swore bitterly, but he did not make the mistake of slapping at the attacker, or of trying to scratch away the barbed sting lodged in his flesh. He worked on calmly, unhurriedly, with the smoke tube. Minutes later, the hive was sufficiently smoke-drugged to allow him to begin cutting away the screen of flowering branches that hid the entrance, and he balanced on a fork of the creeper, using both hands to swing the axe, perched like a little yellow monkey 40 feet above where Zuga lay. What the thunder! He stopped after a dozen axe blows and stared at the cliff face that he had exposed. Master, there's devil's work here. The tone of his voice alerted Zuga, and he scrambled to his feet. What is it? Yanshurut's body obscured the object of his amazement, and impatiently Zuga crossed to the foot of the cliff and climbed hand over hand up the serpentine stem of the creeper. He reached Yanshurut's side and clung to a handhold. Look, Yanshurut exhorted him. Look at that! He pointed at the stone face that he had exposed with the axe. It took Zuga a few seconds to realize that the entrance to the hive was through a geometrically perfect sculptured aperture, one of a series which pierced the cliff face in a broad horizontal band that seemed to extend unbroken in both directions along the cliff face. The decorated band was in chiseled stone blocks, arranged in a chevron pattern, a latticework that was without question the work of a skilled stonemason. The realization jolted Zuga so that he almost missed his handhold, and immediately afterwards he saw something else that up to that moment had been hidden by the dense covering of climbing plants and the thick coating of old outpouring wax from the beehive. The entire cliff face was formed of perfect blocks of dressed stone, small blocks so neatly fitted that they had appeared on casual inspection to be a solid sheet of rock. Zuga and Yanshurut were suspended near the top of the massive stone wall, 40 feet high, so thick and long that it seemed to be a granite hillock. It was a monumental work of stonemasonry, to compare with the outer wall of Solomon's temple, a vast fortification which could only be the periphery of a city forgotten and overgrown with trees and creepers, undisturbed over the ages. "Near what?" whispered Yanshurut. "This is a devil's place. This is the place of Satan himself. Let's go, master," he pleaded. "Let's go far away and very fast." The circuit of the walls took Zuga almost an hour, for the growth was thicker along the northern curve of the stone rampart. The wall seemed to be laid out in an almost perfect circle and without openings. At two or three likely points, Zuga hacked away the growth and searched the foot of the wall, looking for a postern or a gateway. He found none. The decorative chevron pattern did not seem to extend around the entire circumference, but covered the eastern quadrant. Zuga wondered at the significance of that. The immediate explanation seemed to be that the decoration would face the rising sun. It seemed likely that the peoples who had built this massive edifice had been sun worshippers. Yanshurut trailed him reluctantly, prophesying the wrath of devils and hobgoblins who guarded this evil place, while Zuga hacked and chopped his way around the walls, completely oblivious of his advice. "There must be a gateway," he grumbled. "How did they get in and out?" "Devils got wings," Yanshurut pointed out broodingly. "They fly. Me, I wish I had wings also to fly the hell away from here." They came again to the point in the wall where they had discovered the beehive. And by then it was almost dark. The sun had disappeared below the treetops. "We'll search for the gate in the morning," Zuga decided. "We're not going to sleep here?" Yanshurut demanded, horrified. Zuga ignored the protest. "Honey for supper," he suggested mildly. And for once he did not sleep that deep hunter's sleep, but lay under his single blanket, his imagination filled with golden idols and treasure houses built out of massive worked stone blocks. Zugo resumed the search again when it was light enough to see the top of the wall silhouetted against the misty pearl sky of dawn. The previous day he had been blinded by his own eagerness and careless in his haste. He had missed the area only a few yards from where they were camped, where the creepers covering the wall had once been hacked away and then had regrown, even more thickly than before. Now, however, a lop branch beckoned him like a finger, the clean cut unmistakably made by an axe. "Yan Shirut," Zuga called him from the cooking fire. "Clean out this rubbish." Zuga showed him the dense secondary growth, and Yan Shirut sauntered away to fetch his axe. While he waited for him to return, Zuga decided that only one person could possibly be responsible for these old, overgrown and healed cut marks on the stems of the vine. Once again, Fuller Ballantyne had been his guide. Yet this time he did not resent it so fiercely. The experience of treading squarely in his father's footsteps was no longer new, and he had his excitement and anticipation to lessen the sting of it. "Hurry," he called to Yan Shirut. "It's been there 1,000 years. It's not going to fall down now," Yan Shirut answered saucily, and spat on his palms before hefting the axe. The little Hottentot was a great deal happier this morning. He had survived a night under the wall without being assailed by even a single hobgoblin, and Zuga had passed the unsleeping hours in describing to him the treasures that might lie beyond that wall. Yan Shirut's temporarily paralyzed avarice had revived sufficiently to imagine himself with his pants filled with gold coin, seated in his favourite tavern on the Cape Town dockside, with a dozen butter-yellow Hottentot beauties crowding close to him to hear the story, while the bartender prized the wax seal off another bottle of Cape Smoke. Now his enthusiasm almost matched that of Zuga himself. He worked swiftly, and when Zuga stooped and peered into the passage that he had cut through the dense secondary growth that had sprung up behind Fuller Ballantyne's axe, he saw the outline of curved portals of the gateway and the chiselled granite steps that led up to the narrow opening. The steps had been worn into a smooth dish shape by the passage of thousands of feet over the centuries, but the gateway had been deliberately blocked with stone and rubble, not the neat stonework of the main wall, but a careless and hurried attempt to seal the entrance, probably in the face of an advancing enemy, Zuga thought. Somebody, probably Fuller Ballantyne, had pulled down this barrier sufficiently to enter. Zuga followed his tracks, the loose stone rolling underfoot. He squeezed his way through the gateway and found that it turned abruptly to the left into a narrow, vegetation-choked passage between high walls open to the sky. His disappointment was intense. He had hoped that once he forced the gateway, all the city and its wonders and treasures would lie before him. Instead, there were many hours of hard, sweating labour facing him. It had been years, 4 years at least, since Fuller Ballantyne had entered through this gate and passageway, and it was as though he had never been. Where the stonework had collapsed, Zuga clambered over it gingerly. The thought and dread of snakes was very much with him since the cave of the Amblimo. The long, narrow passage, obviously constructed as a defensive measure against intruders, followed the curve of the main wall until abruptly it opened into a clear space, again choked with dense, green, thorny growth, and dominated by a tall, cylindrical tower of lichen-covered granite blocks. The tower was immense, seeming, in Zuga's excitement, to reach to the very clouds. Zuga started across the intervening courtyard, hacking impatiently at the bush and creepers, and halfway across he saw that there was a second tower, an identical twin to the first, that had until that moment obscured it. Now his heart was pounding fiercely against his ribs, not from the exertion of swinging the axe, but with an intuitive belief that the towers were the centre of this strange ancient city, and that they held the key to the mystery. He stumbled in his haste, and went down on his knees, tearing another long rent in his breeches and abrading a strip of skin from his shin, so he swore in his impatience and his pain. He had lost the axe, but when he groped for it in the tangled roots and the interwoven branches, he found it almost immediately, and at the same time uncovered the stone that had tripped him. It was not the granite of which the walls and tower had been constructed. That fact caught his attention, and still on his knees he used the axe to clear the bush around the stone. He felt his nerves thrill as he realized that it was a work of sculpture. Yan Shirut had come up behind him, and now he knelt also and tore at the plants with his bare hands. Then the two of them rocked back on their heels and, still squatting, examined the statue that they had uncovered. It was not large, probably weighed less than 100 weight. It was carved in satiny greenish soapstone, sitting on that familiar ornamental plinth, the simple pattern of triangles, like a row of shark's teeth. The head was smashed off the statue, seemingly by a blow from a sledgehammer, but more likely from a rock used as a hammer. The body of the statue was still intact, the body of the raptor, with the folded pointed wings of a bird of prey, crouching on the point of flight. Zuga slipped his hand into the opening of his shirt and drew out the little ivory charm on its leather thong that he had taken from the body of the Mashona chieftain he had killed at the pass of the Elephant Road. He let it nestle in the palm of his hand, comparing it with the statue. Beside him, Yan Shirut murmured, "It's the same bird." "Yes," Zuga agreed softly. "But what does it mean?" He dropped the ivory charm back inside his shirt. "It's from long ago," Yan Shirut shrugged. "We will never know." And dismissing it thus, he would have risen to his feet again, but something else caught his beady bright eye, and he darted forward, his hand pecking at the loose earth beside the statue like a greedy hen, and held it up between thumb and forefinger to catch the slanted morning light. It was a perfectly round bead of metal, pierced for the string of a necklace. A tiny bead only slightly bigger than the head of a wax vesta, and it was irregular in shape, as though beaten out under the hammer of a primitive smithy. But the colour was red-yellow, and its surface was undulled by either tarnish or corrosion. There is only one metal that has that peculiar lustre and sheen. Zuga held out his hand for it almost reverently, and it had the weight and the warmth of a living thing. "Gold," said Zuga. And beside him, Yan Shirut giggled ecstatically, like a young bride at her first kiss. "Gold," he agreed. "Good yellow gold." Zuga was always aware of the very limited time left to him, and every hour or so as they worked, he would lift his head to the sky with the sweat streaming down his face and neck and greasing the flat, hard muscles of his naked upper body, and always the clouds were taller and blacker, the heat more punishing and the wind sullen as a captive tribe on the point of rebellion. In the night he would start awake, breaking up through the drugged surface of exhausted sleep, to lie and listen to the thunder growling below the horizon like a man-killing monster. Each dawn he shook his men from their blankets and drove them in a suppressed frenzy of impatience to their labour. And when Matthew, the gun-bearer, refused to rise again after the short rest which Zuga allowed them in the hottest hour of the day, Zuga dragged him to his feet and hit him once, a short, perfectly timed chopping blow that sent him spinning backwards full length into his own excavation. Matthew crawled out again, with blood dribbling from his chin, and picked up the crude sieve of plaited split bamboos with which he was sifting the earth from the digging, and began again working over the piles of loose earth and rubble. Zuga drove himself harder than he drove his small band of temple plunderers. He worked shoulder to shoulder with them, as they cut out all the undergrowth from the courtyard below the twin stone towers, exposing the broken cobbles, the piles of loose rubble amongst which lay the fallen statues. He found 6 more of the bird carvings, virtually undamaged, except for minor chips and the attrition of the ages. But there were the fragments of others that had been broken with the savagery which could only have been deliberate, so that he was uncertain of the original number of statues. Zuga spent little time puzzling over them. The loose earth and rubble on which they lay was rich ground for his band to pick over, though they were handicapped by the lack of tools. Zuger would have paid 100 guineas for a set of good picks and spades and buckets. However, they had to make do with sharpened wooden stakes, the tips hardened in the fire, to dig out the loose stuff, and Jan Sharoot wove baskets of split bamboo, like the flat baskets used by the African women to winnow the stamped corn meal. And with these they sieved the fine earth after picking over it by hand. It was tedious, back-breaking work, and the heat was murderous, but the harvest was rich.